Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. A reminder that you can subscribe to us. And if you like what you hear, you can leave a positive comment, which helps us in some way that I don't fully understand, but I'm willing to take people's words for it. Very special guest today, Linda Chavez, a nationally syndicated columnist and friend of the Bulwark. Linda, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it very much.
Great to be with you, Charlie.
Well, there's so many things to talk about. I mean, obviously, I want to talk about immigration, what's happening on the border, the president's first veto looming about the wall. But you had a very intriguing column about last week that you said this was Donald Trump's most important week, or at least that was the headline they put on your column. And, of course, it was the confluence of the Michael Cohen testimony and the failure of the talks in North Korea. So why did you think it was the most, what were you thinking when you said it was the most important week of the presidency? Has there been a lot, lot of big weeks for the Trump president?
A lot of big weeks. Well, first of all, I think in terms of the Cohen hearing, there were some very important markers laid down. I know everyone has been focused on Russia and collusion or collaboration, whatever you want to call it. But I've always believed that the real story in terms of Donald Trump and Russia had to do with money, that it goes back decades, and that the most fruitful way to explore it is to take a look at his financial records, to get a hold of his taxes, and to find out his various business dealings. And I thought that Michael Cohen opened the door to that, and we've obviously seen the Democrats rushing through this week to demand the production of lots and lots of documents related to the Donald Trump organization, his businesses, and also the kinds of forms he has filed over the years when he went to get a loan or he went to apply for insurance, et cetera. And that, frankly, could end up getting him in some real hot water. So obviously that was very important. But all of that was taking it was taking place at the exact same time as the president was in Vietnam. He was there to negotiate supposedly a deal with North Korea on their nuclear weapons. And I really was worried that Trump was going to use that to try to divert attention away from his problems at home and come up with some phony bad deal with North Korea. And so I was quite relieved that he walked away from the table. To me, that was a good thing for Trump to have done, not just for Trump, but frankly for the world.
Yeah, it would have been better if he had not absolved the North Korean thuggish dictator for the death of Otto Warmbier. That would have been a better thing.
Absolutely. That would certainly have been a better thing. And, you know, I mean, that's obviously something that's coming back to bite him now. And clearly, human rights is not an issue for Donald Trump. He doesn't care. He doesn't care what these brutal dictators do. But to try to pretend that Kim Jong-un was not intimately involved and did not know hour by hour what was happening with Otto Warmbier is to be naive or willfully blind in the extreme, because nothing goes on in North Korea of that import without Kim Jong-un knowing about it and directing it, frankly.
You know, I mean, we've said this before, but there has been a certain numbing effect of the Trump presidency, that the president of the United States saying some of the things that he said about one of the world's most bloodthirsty, blood-soaked dictators and his, you know, apparent indifference or insensitivity to the family of a young American citizen who was, in effect, murdered by the Koreans. We've sort of gotten used to Trump saying these things. And I was also struck by a line from your column where you're talking about Michael Cohen's testimony, that Cohen laid out evidence that Donald Trump, the president of the United States, may have defrauded banks, insurance companies, and tax authorities by inflating or deflating for tax purposes the value of his property over the course of years with phony financial statements, which, if true, would be felonies under federal and state law. He also produced checks signed by the president, the president's eldest son, and the chief financial officer of his business to reimburse Cohen for a $131,000 payment to Stormy Daniels to buy her silence on the eve of an election. Now, Linda, on Earth 2.0, this might actually be a really big story. The fact that we're talking about the president of the United States.
Yeah.
And here's something that just came out a couple of moments before, you know, we started talking. There's a new Quinnipiac poll that 64%, that's almost two-thirds of Americans, say that Trump committed crimes before becoming president. 45% of Americans say they think that Trump, the president of the United States, committed crimes while in office. I mean,
yeah, isn't that amazing? And then the Republicans, you know, faint at the very mere mention of the word impeachment. You know, I'm old enough, Charlie, to have not only lived through the impeachment of Richard M. Nixon, but I was actually a young staffer on the Judiciary Committee during the impeachment. And so I'm very familiar with what went on. I was actually a Democrat at the time, worked on the Democratic staff, which of course was the majority staff. And it was very interesting to see what happened with Republicans and how slowly but surely, as the evidence was laid before them, they began to change. And Larry Hogan, the father senior, the father of the current governor of Maryland, is the one who finally broke ranks and, in fact, was the first person, I think, to jump on the impeachment bandwagon. And that, you know, that's a very sobering lesson as we watch Republicans today do everything they can to excuse the behavior of this president.
This raises an interesting question. I mean, that is another era. I mean, it's in our lifetimes, but it is another era. I wonder whether, you know, our politics have become so tribal that the Republicans members of the House would be willing to do that. Look at the evidence and slowly come around. I mean, also, you worked on a committee that had the, you know, extinct Southern Democrat, I mean, extinct now,
right?
Southern Democrats. And you also had a, if I recall, you know, a chairman, Peter Rodino, who really made it, went out of his way to make the whole process nonpartisan, work with those Southern Democrats, work with those Republicans. But it is one of those moments in American history where Nixon loyalists, solid Republicans, look at the evidence and say, you know what, I'm going to put country over party, and I'm just not going to go along with this. I wonder whether that could happen again.
Yeah, you know, you do sort of wonder. I mean, I talked about it in that sentence in my column about the checks that were written. And there hasn't been a whole lot of attention on this, but it wasn't just the president who signed from his own personal bank account, thereby reimbursing an illegal campaign contribution to his campaign and facilitating a cover-up of that. But it was also his son and the CFO of his trust. Now, the president is not supposed to have anything to do with that trust. It's a blind trust, right? That's where he put his money in. And nobody seems to have focused on that fact either, that again is the president essentially directing the expenditure of funds from a trust that he has claimed to the American people he doesn't have anything to do with. So, I mean, the norms that have been broken on this, the kinds of flagrant flouting, not just of the law, but of all of the norms of politics, has been astounding. And yet, you know, he goes to CPAC and he literally makes love to the flag, and they cheer him on and they treat him. I mean, looking at, you know, the snippets I watched from that, it was like watching something out of North Korean television, where the way they treat the young leader, the dear leader in the past, it was a kind of hero worship and idolatry that I just haven't seen. And I worked in the White House under President Reagan. He was never treated with that kind of adoration, that these people have.
I've made this point a couple of times that, again, to use the phrase, I'm old enough to remember when, if you were a Republican or conservative and you criticized other Republican presidents, whether it's, you know, Reagan or Bush 1 or Bush 2, it wasn't a hair on fire excommunication. You didn't have all of the wombats come down on you. That dissent was not on every issue, of course. I mean, there were some that were more intense than others. But it wasn't this. There was not this demand for conformity or the outrage about your disloyalty if you broke with the president. You know, I'm going to go back to this the North Korean thing, because we mentioned Otto Warmbier, and you do talk about this extensively in your column. You actually, in your career, you know something about this human rights. You actually worked on that as well, and probably some of our listeners aren't aware of that experience that you have.
Right. For 4 years, I was the U.S. expert to the United Nations Subcommission on Human Rights in Geneva. So I went every summer for the month of August and participated in hearings there and got to know, frankly, a fair amount about what was going on in North Korea, and was actually even invited to North Korea. And this would have been in 1992, I believe, or 93. To go to Pyongyang because I had been appointed what is called a special rapporteur on the issue of reparations for the comfort women, the Korean and other women that were taken and forced into prostitution by Japan. And North Korea was very interested in getting reparations from Japan. And so I was invited by a delegate to the United Nations to fly to Pyongyang. It was not all that long that I had before that I had been in the White House, and I feared, I think probably rightly, that I would get over there and they would decide that I wasn't going to give them what they wanted, and that, you know, I might not have had as terrible a thing as happened to Otto Warmbier, but that it would have not been a good thing. So I ended up not going. But it really started me, you know, thinking a lot about North Korea. I've published a variety of short stories about North Korea, North Korea's prison camps. Some of those stories can be read in Commentary magazine. So I've spent a lot of time poring over satellite pictures of the North Korean gulag, reading all of the accounts of people who have defected or have been able to escape from North Korea. It's been something that's been very, very near and dear to my heart for many years.
So here's the quote from the president. Trump claimed to bring up Otto Warmbier's treatment to Kim. He tells me that he didn't know about it, and I will take him at his word. Those prisons are rough. They're rough places, and bad things happen. But I really don't believe that he was. I don't believe he knew about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's insane. First of all, when he calls them prisons, I mean, an American hears that and thinks, well, yeah, it's jails and prisons, you know, can be rough. People can get beat up, et cetera. We're not talking about prisons. We're not talking about places where people go because they've committed a crime. These are political prisons. They are a gulag. It isn't just individuals who are accused of being disloyal to the Kim family and the regime. It can be their parents and their children who are incarcerated with them. And the whole point of being there is essentially to work them to death. They are starved. They
tortured.
Are put into forced labor. They are tortured. They are experimented on for medical purposes. And an American who is put into that situation, first of all, it doesn't happen unless it is directed by the leader himself, by Kim Jong-un. It is not that some local official finds an American student has stolen a poster, which is what he was accused of doing. There was a propaganda poster and was going to take it back home. And so he decides, well, I'm going to put him in jail and teach him a lesson. No, that doesn't happen. This has international implications, and any local official who acted on his own would himself end up in the gulag if it was not done at the direct order of Pyongyang and Mr. Kim himself. So this is, as I say, I don't know if it's blind or naive, but the man clearly knows nothing about the North Korean system if he doesn't realize that Kim Jong-un was personally responsible.
Yeah, as you point out, these prisons, quote-unquote prisons, which are really, you know, designed to torture, starve, and work people to death, are at the heart of the North Korean totalitarian system and keep the man that Trump claims to have fallen in love with in power. And then you cite some numbers that under Kim, thousands, tens of thousands of North Koreans have died in these camps. And Kim has directly ordered the execution and imprisonment of more than 400 officials and their families in political purges since he came to power in 2011.
Family. Yeah. And his family as well. I mean, not only did he order the poisoning of his half-brother, but he also ordered the killing by artillery fire, by firing a rocket, essentially, at his uncle, because he worried that, you know, he was somehow going to be a threat. I mean, the Kim family, the three generations that have been in power, have all ruled in this way. You know, it was Kim Il-sung, the founder of North Korea, who said that the bad seed will be persecuted to the third generation. So in other words, you commit a crime and your children and grandchildren or your parents, you and your children can all end up in these camps and essentially be worked to death.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, let's switch. It's so nightmarish. And, you know, I mentioned this, the fact that we've become numb to it. It's like, well, you know, Trump being Trump, that we've just lowered the bar so far. So on immigration, it looks like the president is going to have to veto the congressional action overriding his emergency declaration. You've obviously been very, very involved in the immigration issue. One of the talking points that we're getting, particularly from some of the House Republicans who voted some time ago to go along with Trump, is that, well, there really is a crisis at the border. Bad things are happening at the border. Things are completely out of control and justify this this sort of emergency order. So give me some sense. What is happening at the border right now? What is the nature of this crisis?
Well, it is not a crisis of the illegal immigration of drugs and criminals and people trying to come in simply to work that are forcing their way through our borders en masse. It's not an invasion, as someone like Michelle Malkin or Sean Hannity or Donald Trump might call it. Illegal immigration into the United States is down to essentially a 40-year low. It has been in decline since the recession of 2008. Illegal immigration into the United States peaked in the years between 1995 and 2000, and it's roughly been on a decline since the early 2000s to the point that we are now at levels that we've not seen since the early 1970s. But there is a crisis, and the crisis has to do with families who are fleeing what have become failed states in some of the various regions in the Northern Triangle, in places like El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, where the narco traffickers essentially have taken over regions and people are being forced into gangs. They're being forced into the narcotics trade and they're being extorted. Those families, rather than see their, you know, 10-year-old boy become a narco trafficker or their, you know, 9-year-old daughter grow up to end up to have to be forced into prostitution by these gangs, are fleeing north. And they are, in fact, legitimately following the laws that are in place right now, which say that you have to step foot on U.S. soil. But once you do that, you can claim asylum and you have a chance to prove that you have a reasonable fear of persecution. And whether we like that law or we don't like that law, that is the law. So these are not people who are lawbreakers. They are, in fact, people who are taking their chance and abiding by the current U.S. law with respect to asylum. And those numbers are way up. They are at their highest point ever. So there is a crisis. And we have to figure out how to solve this crisis. And I think that, you know, some of the people on the open borders side of the argument will say, you know, just let everybody in and we'll deal with it. And then those on the closed, you know, we don't want anybody, will say, no, we just send them all back home. And, well, you know, I do think we have some responsibilities. These narcotics that are being produced and moved through that area are feeding an American appetite for illegal drugs. I mean, there is a pull from our country that is pulling these drugs north. And so I think we do have some responsibility to try to figure out what to do to try to get the countries themselves to be able to deal with the situation better in their home places. These are not people who necessarily want to become Americans, come here and live here forever. Most people would rather live peaceably in their own homes, but they can't do that right now. And so we do have to work this through, but neither side of this very polarized debate seems willing to sit down and figure it out and say, okay, how do we solve this crisis?
Yeah, the Times writes about this, the surge of the families. The high number of families crossing the border suggests that Trump's policies aimed at deterring asylum seekers are not having the intended effect. And it is interesting that in the past, Mexico has been the most popular country of origin. Now, 96% of apprehended family members, this would be so far in fiscal year 2019, have come from either Guatemala, Honduras, or El Salvador, as well as 83% of the unaccompanied minors. Do you have a sense, what's happened that's changed this? What has flipped the switch down there that has causing this sort of a surge?
I mean, the good news is Mexico is doing better than it has in the past, and there are more opportunities for people, for Mexicans, to stay in Mexico and to find jobs. Trump likes to talk about how terrible NAFTA was. Well, one of the things NAFTA did is help, you know, the economy of Mexico. I would argue it also helped the American economy, but whatever, it clearly helped Mexico, and Mexico is people are being better educated. There are more opportunities, so Mexicans are deciding to stay and are not coming in. And in fact, there's a net outflow of Mexican-born persons from the United States. It's not just that there's zero, it's that there are actually more Mexicans leaving the United States than are coming in legally and illegally. But what's happening in those other states is this terrible breakdown in law enforcement. Now, it's actually gotten just slightly better in the last year or so, but the murder rates in some of these places are among the highest in the world, some of the most dangerous places in the world to live. The gangs essentially control regions in places like El Salvador. You know, President Trump likes to talk about MS-13 and its problems here in the United States. Well, the real problem with MS-13 is in El Salvador, where, you know, MS-13 controls whole regions of the country. So people, you know, if you're given a choice, okay, my daughter's going to be forced to be a prostitute, or my son's going to be forced to be a drug dealer, or I travel, you know, hundreds of miles north and take my chance, and maybe I end up in detention, and so does my child. I mean, what are you going to choose?
Yeah,
you're going to choose the latter. I mean, it's better than the alternative, which could be death, prostitutions, or forced into criminality. So, you know, you can't blame the parents. They are trying to protect their children.
And, of course, it almost goes without saying, the wall does nothing to address these problems. Because, as you point out, as asylum seekers, they're not crossing in the desert. They're not crossing in open territory. They are showing up at the legally designated ports of entry.
And, by the way, even if they were to cross in the desert, because some of them do, in fact, when they can't get through at the proper border crossing, they go, you know, a few miles down the road and cross illegally. But they still walk up to the first border agent they see and turn themselves in. Because, again, that's what the law not only says, it's what it requires. So, so the wall is not going to really change that. It's going to have to be, I think you need, you know, a kind of Marshall Plan for Central America that the United States should be involved in. It is in our interest. This is our hemisphere. And it is in our interest that those countries succeed and prosper and that we do what has happened with Mexico, which is encourage people to stay at home and build their lives there by giving them the opportunity to do so. We spend a paltry amount of money. It's in the few hundreds of millions of dollars in aid to those three countries. Better that $6 billion going to the wall would be spent in helping these countries deal with their problems and keep people there where they'd rather be anyway.
That seems, of course, diametrically opposed to the America First nationalism of Trump, who certainly does not want to spend money in other countries, even though this would clearly be in America's special interest. Okay, I have an issue that I'm slightly obsessed about, and I don't know whether you're obsessed about it as well. And it's not on our list of things to talk about, but, you know, just bear with me, okay? This measles outbreak. in what we're experiencing. Mm. It really is a sign of, I think, some of the things that are so wrong with our politics, that we have a measles outbreak because of bad ideas, you know, that ideas have consequences. And this, the tolerance and the spread of, you know, anti-vaxxer propaganda is, you know, leading to the resurgence of a disease that we had eradicated. And
right.
It's one of those things where it is so unnecessary, it is so damaging, and it is so based upon misinformation, ignorance, and this anti-science culture that we have, that we've nurtured. It's kind of mind-blowing.
It really is, and I am astonished. I mean, I didn't even know this until I was reading some of the articles about it, that, you know, so many states don't require parents to vaccinate their kids. Well, okay, then don't let them go to public school.
Which, by the way, is exactly the right answer. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
All right. You don't want to vaccinate your kid. You keep them home. You're not only going to homeschool them, but, you know, they're not going to be allowed to go out in public. I mean, if, you know, if you want to go live off in the wilderness somewhere and not have any other contact with other human beings, maybe you have the right to do with you what you want. But if you're going to live in civil society and you're going to be interacting, then it's not just, you know, your right to not have a vaccine. It is the right of others that you not be exposed to them and bring diseases that are going to infect other people.
And they unveiled this new study, you know, a decade-long study of 500,000 people, once again saying the measles vaccine does not cause autism. But as we've experienced over the last several years, it's hard to have information penetrate into all of these silos. There's always a place that you will go that is going to, you know, encourage skepticism or denial. So, you know, it's got to be an incredibly frustrating moment for public health experts, educators who are going, look, the science on this is really, really clear. This is not a red blue issue. This should not be a Democrat Republican issue or a right left issue. This is like, we succeeded in eradicating measles. We have some crackpots and many people who are sincerely misled by those crackpots who have now opened the door to something that is going to have really negative consequences for so many folks. And it is one of those many, many moments that we have where you sort of want to pound your head on a desk. So
Well, the conservative, you know, one branch of the conservative movement becoming the anti-science movement to me is very disheartening, because science is perfectly compatible with conservatism. Yeah. And to be anti-science is really, it's really sad.
Yeah, and it is, you know, as Tom Nichols talked about, the death of expertise, the contempt for experts, and the willingness to ignore all of that, which is not a good trend in our century. Linda Chavez, thank you so much for joining me and talking with us. We've covered a lot of ground here, and I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.